Casey Bauman. I'm the NWTF district biologist over Arkansas, Louisiana, and Mississippi, and this is the Prairie Farm Podcast.
I'm Doug Duren, a landowner trying to be a conservationist.
I'm Tabitha Panis, president of the Iowa Prairie Network.
I'm Ryan Callahan, director of conservation at Meat Eater.
Angela from Axe and Root Homestead.
Chris Helzer, the Nebraska director of science for the Nature Conservancy.
Judd McCullum from Working Class Bowhunter.
Taylor Keene, founder of Sacred Seed.
I'm Ryan Bryson with Bryson Wildlife.
This is Luke Fritsch.
This is James Holtz.
Joy Van Weingarten.
Sam Sobel.
Phil Ebert.
Julie Meechan.
And you are listening to the Prairie Farm.
The Prairie Farm.
Prairie Farm.
Prairie Farm Podcast. Welcome to the Prairie Farm Podcast. Casey, could you list, I don't know, I guess we could kind of do this like a game, although I don't think Nicholas is going to be very competitive.
At what?
I thought we
what
could
game?
Like...
Ken, I'm always competitive.
Do you remember when we interviewed Julie Meechan, the professor?
Yeah, and I freaking slammed you. I freaking won. I won. I beat the doctor.
No, I think you did technically beat me because I named an animal that was not from the Pleistocene.
Well, and I got all the easy ones.
Yes. But
basically,
anyways,
it was a paleontologist that right. We were naming as many animals as we could from Ice Age eras. And I would for sure lose normally, but Kent was letting me have all the easy ones like woolly mammoth and saber-toothed tiger.
I was even helping him get his answers.
Yeah, but Julie knew like hundreds. So anyway,
but what the game I was thinking of? There's so many subspecies of wild turkeys. I thought we could like go around.
Oh,
and name,
dude, I could do that.
And name the different subspecies of wild turkeys that there are.
Oh, yeah.
So we'll let our guest, who we'll more formally introduce here in a minute. We always like to start hot on this podcast. Casey, we'll let you go first. Could you name a subspecies of wild turkey for us?
Yeah, sure. Rio Grande.
Ooh, well, good one.
That's a good one.
She was very kind to you, Nicholas. She left you the easy one.
No. You go next. I think I'll be better at this than you think.
I'm going to go with Goulds.
Goulds. Oh, okay. Slow roasted. Nobody
I had no idea. Well, I was like, what? Did he like research this beforehand or something?
I don't know.
You were just playing it off like you knew. Oh man. Slow. That was good. That was good, Nicholas. Even though you've been up till 3 a.m.
How echoey is this room? Is it too echoey?
No, it's good.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, cool.
Anyway, yeah. So yeah, slow roasted. That I think I lose in that one.
I think you're officially out. So so back to you, Casey.
Miriam.
Very good. Miriam's. You know, I just saw Miriam wild turkeys for the first time in my life, I think. I don't remember ever seeing them, but in the sand hills of Nebraska last week. Beautiful birds. I love the white tips on their fan. On their tail feathers or their fan, I guess you'd say.
Those are the ones you see in like the pilgrim hats.
Nope. Those would be another one. So,
what was the easy one you were thinking I would get?
Go ahead, Casey. You could say it. It's your turn, anyways. No, it is mine, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's
your
you
turn.
Said Miriam. Okay, yeah.
I'm trying to get it.
All right, I'll say it. Eastern wild turkey.
Yep.
That's like but then you could just say like southern wild turkey.
No, you can't. Because easterns are down south where Casey's at too. and then I think is there just one subspecies left? Yeah, I think so. Might be
whose turn in this?
I think it's yours, Kate. Well, we can let Nicholas try again. You got another?
Oh yeah,
joke
yeah,
for
yeah
us?
Totally. what's it in football when you get a turkey?
That's
or
in,
like there's
that's
a
in
sport
hockey.
Term.
That's hockey.
What's that?
Oh, no, it's not. It's bowling. hockey is a hat trick. Bowling, it's
a turkey is three in a row.
Right. Three strikes.
Three
in a row.
Yes. Yeah, see?
Bowling turkey. Okay.
30 pin turkey. It's not as funny. You got to explain it slowly as we're trying. I should just Google it.
Right. Right. So then the last one, I believe, right, Casey?
Yeah. I think it's Osceola.
Yep.
We didn't say that one right. Okay.
Right.
Oh.
Yep. And that's down in Florida. And I always, so there's an Osceola, Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And it's spelled the exact same way, but just pronounced differently. And I always forget which one is Osceola and which one is Osceola. And, yep. So there's that. And then there's the whole other. So I'll ask you this, Casey, the oscillated turkey, how do you classify that as a true turkey? Or, cause aren't there some folks that say, no, it's more similar to like what's the right term? Peacocks are in this this genus or this family, I guess.
It was once considered a descendant of peacocks, but they noticed that the genealogy was very similar to actually, you know, turkeys in general. So they actually, you know, classified it as a turkey instead of a descendant of the peacock. Yep.
Okay.
Interesting.
And the genetic difference between the oscillated turkeys and other turkey species is just so small that they couldn't justify putting it in its own category.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. It's a fascinating thing. And, so coming from my side, and I assume Casey's as well, working with NWTF, I'm a part of the hunting community. There's a lot that goes into all of those different subspecies. There's different like lifetime achievements of going and successfully harvesting these different subspecies, and then even of course the whole other species of the oscillated, and they're called different variations of slams, right? So there's like there's a grand slam, which I think is just the North American grand slam. Is that where you
all of in 1 year?
No, in a lifetime. So
that's
when you would harvest all of the subspecies. But then there's like the super slam, which is every American state that has a wild turkey species in it. And some of those states, like Nebraska, I think has three, right? Because it has Rios.
That
has,
is way harder.
Yeah.
It's not even comparable.
It's insane. I can't even imagine achieving that.
The grand slam, the like North American grand slam, should be called like the small tick, and then the other one can be called a super slam. They're not comparable.
It's a much lower bar.
What does Iowa have?
Iowa has easterns, only easterns.
Okay, yep. Cool.
But then there's also the Royal Slam. Is that when you go and get the oscillated as well?
I believe so. Yeah.
So there's all these different, and I think it's, and maybe this would be a good time to bring this up. I just had this conversation recently with a friend of mine who's working on his grand slam and has actually, he lives in Nebraska. He was the one I was visiting in the Sandhills where I saw the Merriams, and they have there in Nebraska what they call a Nebraska slam, since they have the Rios, the Merriams, and the Easterns over there. So he's already done that, of course, but now he's working on his grand slam. He just went down to Florida and got his Osceola. See, I struggle on knowing which one to say because of that dang town in Iowa. But he still needs to go to Gould, or go to the Southwest for Goulds, and I think he's working on another an out-of-state Rio this year. So I think he's going to Kansas to do that. Okay. So
cool.
But we, in talking with him, we were wondering, you know, in some of these places, like especially for the Osceolas down in Florida and the Oscillateds, which are just in the Yucatan Peninsula, right? Is that the only place they're found?
That's correct.
Has there been any like negative population effects on those, well, I guess one subspecies and one species, because of like the whole slam program, that now there's like extra motivation? Because I got to think that before anyone knew about the turkey slams, there were probably exactly zero folks traveling from the United States to the Yucatan Peninsula to go kill a turkey. You know, and now I don't know how many people that is. I'm sure it's not a ton, but it's definitely not zero. And is there any evidence that the slams have negatively impacted those smaller populations of birds like Osceolas or Oscillateds?
I don't know of any negative effects. You know, most of that stuff, when you think about, you know, the Yucatan Peninsula, the oscillated turkeys, you know, a lot of that is guided hunts. So a lot of it, they go down with an outfitter and kind of do that type of thing. And then, of course, those outfitters are only allotted a certain number of tags to be able to harvest the turkeys. So I don't know of any. That's not saying that there possibly isn't a negative effect on the population. I haven't seen anything in relation to that.
Sure. Yeah, that's good to hear. You always wonder, you know, good hunters try to be ethical and conservation minded, but sometimes I think we can get a little caught up in the side stuff, you know, and especially with Osceolas. 'Cause I do know a lot of hunters who have, you know, gone out of their way to go down to Florida to tag an Osceola. And so, it's good to know though, that doesn't seem to be the case, and we'll get into more population stuff with turkeys, because that's probably going to be the biggest part of today's conversation. But first, we want to introduce our guests. We have a National Wild Turkey Federation. Did you think the F was foundation, Nicholas?
Yes, I did. I think I've said foundation a couple of times. Federation. Yeah. Who uses that word anymore?
I think it's cool that they use federation instead of foundation. Keeps you guessing, but. But
makes me think that they only do business in handwritten letters. Like they review, they don't send emails, they just handwritten.
It's like
letters.
It's kind of like referring to Virginia as the Commonwealth. What does that even mean? But what's a Commonwealth? Anyways.
Yes.
Anyway, sounds socialistic to me, but anyways. Nicholas, big socialist guy. But,
big fan of giving all my money away to someone else to use it poorly. Big fan.
Oh man, talking politics. But no, so most people know the National Wild Turkey Foundation as its nickname, the NWTF. But Casey is a biologist, wildlife biologist with NWTF. And your last name is pronounced Bauman, right?
Yes.
Yep, Casey Bauman. So, and I got to say, how did I end up getting connected with Casey? Well, I know a lot of folks in Pheasants Forever. Somebody you might actually know, Casey, you mentioned that you do some work in Arkansas, Sierra Rhodes from Quail Forever. I don't know if you've ever worked on any projects with her, but we had,
I was just going to say, I know the name. I've never met her in person.
Sure. But, she's been on this podcast. Actually, we met her at Pheasant Fest, in 2023 and, she did quite a few presentations at Pheasant Fest actually. And, we were super impressed by her knowledge you know, the whole story of the bobwhite quail down in really the southeastern part of our country is pretty sobering, and one that there's some encouraging stuff going on with too. And, so anyways, I wanted to have this turkey conversation for over a year. Nicholas and I have been talking about it, and obviously it works well to do it right now because turkey season's going on around the country, and people are interested in turkeys now more than they are most times of the year. So makes perfect sense to record this one. And I was like, you know, we need to talk to somebody who's like maybe in the thick of the population concerns that are going on kind of around the country, but it seems to be most concerning down in the southeastern part of our country on what's going on with wild turkey populations. Why are they declining a little bit? And so I wanted to make sure that we talked with somebody who, you know, the easy thing would just be to call somebody up here in Iowa, but I think Casey's going to have probably a more like boots on the ground experience with seeing these things play out before her eyes. And so, I just, looked up, through the different regions, or I think it even goes by state on, the NWTF website, like like look for a biologist type thing. And I was like, Mississippi, that sounds like a good place that probably knows what's going on. And right away, Casey's name popped up and she was kind enough to answer an email from a complete stranger and come on our show today. But thank you so much, Casey, for joining us. And I just want to start out, where did your interest in becoming a wild biologist, where did that come from?
So I grew up actually in Missouri, kind of southeast Missouri, in a small town, St. Genevieve, Missouri. It's about 70 miles south of St. Louis on the Mississippi River there. And we had cows and, you know, growing up, and ducks, and kind of like a little small farm that I grew up on. And, you know, we were real big into deer hunting. We would always have during rifle season every year, you know, family come out, camp over, we'd do bonfires and hay rides and stuff the evening, and everybody would go deer hunting, you know, during the day. So I kind of grew up in that atmosphere, you know, of hunting and that type of thing. So, I went to school and, I decided I wanted to do something with wildlife. So I ended up, graduating with my master's, from Southeast Missouri State University in Cape Girardeau, Missouri. And, you know, ultimately decided to go the wildlife route. I was kind of thinking possibly veterinary school. But I'm glad I chose the wildlife route, because, you know, I like working outside, in the outdoors, kind of, you know, talking with people about their land management and that type of thing. So, you know, after graduation, NWTF was kind of one of the places that I applied to. I always, took a little interest in their organization and their values and their mission. And, they ended up calling me back, and I thought it was going to be a good fit. So, they asked me if, I would be willing to move to Mississippi. And I said, well, yeah. I don't know if it's my destination state, but if that's what you got, you know, I'm more than willing to give it a go. So I've been with NWTF actually a little over 8 years now. I had my 8 year work anniversary at the beginning of this month. So, but yeah, I've been working with them for about 8 years in various roles. And right now, I'm the district biologist over Arkansas, Louisiana, and Mississippi.
Wow, that's a big area to cover. Do you spend yeah. a lot of your time on the road?
Not so much now. I guess that was one of the good things that kind of came out of COVID. Everybody had to learn how to do virtual meetings, right? So a lot of my meetings and phone calls and stuff like that, I can do virtually now. I do get a chance to go out in the field, you know, and visit a couple sites and see, you know, what work I have actually been working on kind of over the computer and over the phone and over the meetings and stuff. So that's really cool. And, you know, I always enjoy trying to get out in the field and see the work that I've been doing, you know, so, yeah. It's very cool. So, luckily, yeah, I don't have to travel as much as, I guess pre-COVID I would have, but I do enjoy it when I get the opportunity.
Yeah, that's great. And it's cool to see how your background in the outdoors, you know, just kind of set the table for you to move into that career space. I'm sure your family's proud of you doing that and the work that you do now, and even being able to give back to what you used to enjoy as a kid growing up and what your family enjoyed. I think that's got to be pretty rewarding when you consider that aspect of what you've been able to achieve so far. But let's talk some turkeys. So I thought it was tempting just to dive
in. And you got a turkey impersonation. Apparently we've been doing those recently.
A turkey impersonation. Oh yeah. We've been making each other do different animal noises on the podcast.
Come on, Ken, what do you got?
We're going to ruin our podcast, Nicholas, if we keep doing it. I actually was driving to work on, when was it? Wednesday morning. And, you know, this is like prime time to be driving back roads and seeing turkeys do some cool turkey stuff. And I was surprised that this area where I normally see about like 20 to 30 birds on my way in, I didn't see any. And I was like, come on. And then when I was almost to work, I drove past this little timber draw out in the middle of an ag field. And across from that, across the road, in the middle of a cornfield, there were two hens and a tom just gobbling his head off. And you know how turkeys just like throw their head out and like fully extend their neck and just
show us how they
I will slip a disc in my spine if I try and do what a turkey does. But I rolled down my window and I was like, you know what, he is keyed up. I'm gonna practice my natural voice hen yelp. And I will do that, Nicholas. I'll give you a hen.
Yes.
I will not gobble, but I will.
All I want.
I watched a video from Preston Pittman, who's like a world champion natural voice caller. And he said, if you want to do a good hen yelp, you have to say the word ow. O-W, ow. But with like a high pitch, like ow, ow, ow.
So you just like sit around and Google. Oh, that's pretty good.
Yeah,
that's pretty good.
It might get a drunk Tom to come walking in, but one who's already taken a few pellets to the brain. I use a box.
You heard it here first, folks. Kent just sits around and Googles who's the best turkey gobbler in the world, just regularly. That's what he does in his free time.
Hunters do weird things, yes, but no. So anyways, let's talk about turkeys in their ecosystems. The first question, it was tempting just to dive in. What's going on with turkeys, Casey? What's with their population? But we need to save that for later. I thought it'd be good just to be like, why are turkeys important? It's obvious to like someone who likes hunting. Yeah, they taste good. You know, that's why they're important to hunters, you know, but from somebody who just cares about wildlife from that standpoint, a great place would be like, where do they fit into their ecosystems? You know, we could look at the energy pyramid, you know, what kind of consumer are they, where, you know, that kind of thing. But you got any like specific information on like why turkeys are important to the ecosystems that they live in?
One of the things right off the top of my head that I can think of is they help disperse seeds and control insect populations. Of course, by the foraging and stuff that they do, and actually with their scratching and foraging behaviors, it creates small disturbances in the soil, which can benefit plant species that we are wanting to grow there, such as forbs and legumes and that type of thing. It helps the seeds to actually germinate. They play a vital role in seed disbursement and that type of thing as well. And then, you know, when you're thinking about the ecosystem as a whole, of course, they're vital food sources, right, for predators. And we don't like to talk about predators much, you know, especially in regards to turkeys. But they do play a vital role in the food chain as
well. What are the major predators?
So it kind of depends on, you know, the life stage of the turkey. When you're thinking about, you know, nesting and eggs and that type of thing, we think a lot about, you know, raccoons, snakes, birds, or, you know, other birds of prey, that type of thing. And then as you get into the adult stages, you know, you think about, you know, coyotes, potentially foxes, mountain lions, that type of thing.
Yeah, that's a great point. As far as a lot of times, I didn't even think of that when I was putting this together. Like some animals do just serve that role as their food source. I mean, obviously the other things that you mentioned too, but that is an important part to consider. You know, like I think that's when I was a biology teacher that I once had a student say, would ecosystems have any problems if all of a sudden mosquitoes stopped existing? And and it's like, yeah, you know, probably the one thing, I mean, they might actually help hold some populations in check, some mammal populations by transmitting diseases to them, I suppose. Unfortunately, we are, our species, the, you know, humans are affected by that, but I'm sure there's other mammals that are too. The best answer I came up with for the student was probably as a food source, they would negatively impact something. And the same thing can be true for something as large as a turkey. That's a great point. But let's go back to that part about the native plants, because obviously we're in the business of that. And so right away, well, I'll quiz Nicholas here. Which species did you think of, Nicholas, when she mentioned the disturbance? Some native species really like disturbance. Disturbed soil. Yeah, a lot of them, but there's one that especially likes it.
That particularly likes disturbed soil. I'm going to guess buffalo grass.
That was not the one I was thinking of. Buffalo. I could see that, though, because buffalo grass likes to be pushed in a little bit deeper.
Yeah.
But I was thinking hoary vervain. Old cow pastures, you see hoary like crazy growing in them because the cows rough up the soil so much and it just really thrives there. But that's really interesting. Is there, and I'm really putting you on the spot here, Casey, so if you're not sure of a specific species, which is kind of a redundant thing to say, do you know of any, like, especially the legume species that turkeys target, or they help proliferate in the, you know, in the environment?
Yeah, so gosh, you're really taking me back to my botany
days. Nobody should have to go back to those days.
Oh god, those were awful. Yeah. Let's see. I'm trying to think. Is it, I can think of the pea, but
partridge pea?
Is it? Yeah, that's it.
Okay. Nice work, Nicholas.
Yeah, so yep, one for the team. Yeah. You know, they you know, can disperse a lot of that stuff. And of course, you know, when you're thinking about you know, poults and them moving through the habitat and stuff, you want kind of that bare ground so they can move freely, but also have that cover as well. So, you know, when we're thinking about bare ground and bunch grasses and that type of thing, you know, they really help with dispersing that on a larger scale than what the plant would actually do itself. And that's a great, you know, example of one that they can disperse.
Yeah, that's great to hear. That's one. So Nicholas had the idea of starting us marketing perennial food plots, and we always preach, you know, legumes. We actually learned that from some reading we've done with different articles from Quail Forever. And it's just good to have a biologist weigh in on, you know, some different species that they know to work well. And one of the nice things about partridge pea is it does a great job proliferating in a prairie. Like, we have some areas on our farm where we used to have partridge pea production that went on. Well, we stopped growing it in those fields. So in other words, we terminated those fields. We sprayed them out to grow something else. And yet those heavy legume seeds hang out in the soil. And, you know, year after year, we get a flush of partridge pea back, even where we've tried to clean it out of those fields. And I always like to see it. Like, it's, from our standpoint, it can be a little bit annoying because it means I got to clean it. When I'm doing the seed cleaning, I have to clean those seeds and separate them from what we are intentionally growing there. But it's also good to know that, like, it's not just all the weed species like water hemp and pigweed, you know, or lamb's quarter and Pennsylvania smartweed are the only things that can, you know, survive an apocalypse. Partridge pea will be there too someday. but that's good to hear. So another thing I was wondering about is, so when you're looking at ecology of anything, you're not just looking at what does this organism do, but how does it interact with other organisms within in that ecosystem. And there's all one of them we just kind of talked about was partridge pea and wild turkeys. But are there any other unique interspecies relationships that turkeys share? Like maybe it's a certain, you know, maybe it's like the whole thing up north with lynx and snowshoe hares, you know, like they just really key on that species. But is there any unique relationships like that?
Turkeys, you know, are kind of, their presence can definitely influence, you know, other animals and that type of thing. One that I can think of, you know, is quail. If there's turkeys and quail relatively in the same area, you know, a lot of times the quail will kind of read the turkey's behavior as to, you know, are there any, dangers in the area, any predators, that type of thing. So they'll kind of take cues off of each other and, you know, be alerted to potential threats.
Interesting. I did not know that.
Yeah, me neither. That's really interesting. So they coexist pretty well then together, quail and turkeys.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. You know, quail, when we think about quail habitat, we think, you know, it's more aggressively managed for quail, but turkeys also, you know, thrive in that type of environment too, or, you know, habitat too, you know, and they can definitely coexist and kind of work off each other in regards to, you know, threats or food sources or that type of thing.
Hmm. Yeah, I think I've heard people refer to quail as like the firebird, because they need prescribed fire so much. But I've also heard that turkeys really like to take advantage of fresh burns, and they go in and forage pretty heavily into fresh burns. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So we kind of consider turkeys the year of disturbance. So when you go in and you do a prescribed burn, a lot of times right after the burn, you'll see turkeys kind of move into that area, and they're picking at, you know, all the, I guess, cooked to order bugs and stuff, you know, that got burnt up. yeah, you turkeys like disturbance as well. So a lot of times when you're thinking about nesting areas or that type of thing, you know, it's the year of disturbance. So it's the year that you prescribe burn the area, you know, it's the year that you went in and harvested timber off that area. They're going in and they're really utilizing that year of disturbance for their benefit.
Okay.
So is that their ideal habitat? Well, I guess maybe not habitat, but like feeding grounds. What's an ideal feeding ground for a turkey? Or does it vary based on subspecies?
I mean, it kind of varies depending upon what region you're in, but it's all, you know, going back to the same thing. You know, they like those high bug areas. So when you're thinking about, you know, plant species and stuff that attract a lot of insects when they're younger, especially poults, you know, they're eating a lot of that. They need that protein from the insects. And then, of course, as they get older, you think about, you know, turkeys, you know, going out and into fields and that type of thing, you know, eating the forbs and the glooms out in those fields. And then, you know, as it transitions throughout the year, you see them going into like streamside management zones where you have a lot of your oaks and acorn producing, you know, trees and stuff. So it kind of turkeys are kind of one of those species that, you know, it kind of almost depends on their life cycle that they're in. So, you know, from poults to an adult turkey, it kind of changes.
That's interesting.
I don't want to forget, I have a fun question for you relating to what turkeys eat. Let me remind me to come back to that, Nicholas. I'm going to ask about turkey crops.
A fun question.
But
turkey digestion.
Yes. But when it comes to managing for turkeys, this relates to what Nicholas just asked and great answer that Casey just gave. But if somebody is wanting to best support turkeys on their, let's say they own like 100-acre farm, and a lot, and hunting is the top priority for owning that farm. And so they're wanting to have more turkeys. What is, if it's the average farm, and we'll say, we'll go to your old stomping grounds, since that's a neighbor to Iowa, Missouri. So down in southeast Missouri, the average 100-acre farm in that area, if somebody wanted to manage for turkeys, like, what's probably going to be the lowest hole in the bucket that they're going to have to fill? Is it going to be habitat improvement, or is it going to be food improvement on their landscape?
It's kind of hard to say, you know, because you can have different variables kind of affecting what that track is actually, you know, having for the turkeys. So, you know, you could have a completely wooded track with no openings and that type of thing. And then you'd want to go in and kind of create those wildlife openings within the timber stands. Of course, you know, Missouri has a lot of oak species and that type of thing. So kind of managing for your streamside management zones and really making sure that you're having very productive oak species as far as acorns and that type of thing. But you also want to make sure that you have enough openings and well-managed openings as well. Whether you have a wildlife opening versus a food plot where you, you know, plant it with clovers or winter wheat or that type of thing, you know, throughout the year, versus a wildlife opening where you could potentially run a burn through to kind of generate that seed bank to produce and stuff. You can also do that via disking and that type of thing throughout the different times a year, fall disking versus, you know, spring disking, that type of thing. You'll get a different response from the seed bank. But, you know, it like I said, it kind of just depends on what you actually have on your property as to, you know, what we would potentially recommend. Some of the things, you know, that we definitely do here in the Southeast is, of course, prescribed burning. Prescribed burning is one of the biggest things. Invasive species control, you want to make sure that, you know, your forested stands are accessible to turkeys. So, you know, if they're overgrown by invasive species, plant species, and that type of thing, you want to make sure that you're getting in there and kind of managing those species so they're not taking over the forested stand, and that forested stand becomes kind of an unproductive area that the turkeys aren't going to utilize. As far as, you know, fields go, of course, you know, where I grew up, you know, we had a lot of huge fields and stuff. And a lot of times you see, especially like in agricultural situations, you see fields where, you know, they're planted with, you know, whatever crop, and then they butt up right next to a forested stand. Another thing, you know, that we talk a lot about is feathering, where you kind of, you have the forested stand, but then you have a step down, you know, into the field. So it's not completely, the field isn't completely one level and the forested stand is the next level. You have that kind of that in-between area where you have a little bit more bushier things than what you would potentially be growing in the field. And that allows for, you know, turkeys and as well as deer and, you know, other animals to have that kind of protection before they actually step out into the field.
What's an example of some bushier species that would fit in that category?
Yeah, that's a good question.
A lot of times you can actually create that habitat in various different ways by either planting a taller crop on the edges as versus in the middle. You can also utilize you know, some shrubs and that type of thing along the edges if you want. You know, a lot of times, at least down here in the Southeast, you know, those shrubs are kind of already growing along through there. But when people go into the fields and they want to plant their stuff, they get rid of all of that. And then again, you have that situation where you have the completely flat of the field and then, you know, a huge, you know, forested stand right up next to it with kind of that feathering effect non-existent in that area. So, you know, any type of bushy or shrubs up along the edge of the field, and or any type of taller plant species that you could potentially plant in the field to kind of give that cover is always a good option as well.
Hmm. Yeah, that's great. I imagine, do you guys have a lot of dogwoods down in Mississippi?
We have quite a few here and there, yes.
Yeah, that's probably one of those good feathering species. And then around here, Nicholas, wild plum.
Is
a good one.
That's native. And, I mean, wild. I bet Tree of Heaven. Not that I'm promoting that, but I bet it. I bet it ends up, you know, creating a similar.
Well, a native that's very similar to that, Nicholas, is sumac.
But aren't sumacs a little thinner?
They aren't as I don't think they grow as tall as Tree of Heaven does. Do you guys have that as a scourge down there in the South, Casey? Tree of Heaven. That invasive.
Oh man, you're putting me on the spot. I don't know. I've never.
You probably don't have it. It's pretty thick here in Iowa.
It looks and like 100 trees lining the roadside, but it's just like one organism.
Yeah, it's kind of like locust trees or I think aspen trees are the same way, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. It'll just be
rhizomous,
one.
Like all sprouting off one.
So it feels like you have a cool aspen forest, but you have one organism that's like. The DNA isn't spread out enough, you know.
Yeah.
It needs more.
Oh, okay. But, interesting.
Yeah, but those would be some tree species that, or I guess shrub species that I could think of that kind of serve that purpose, at least up here. I'm sure it's different down there to some extent. But this made me think of another thing too. Is kudzu a problem in Mississippi?
I have no idea.
In certain areas, it is a pretty big problem down here in the South. And, you know, if you're familiar with kudzu, you know, it pretty much takes over everything.
Yeah. What is it? Is it a grass? Or
you would recognize it, Nicholas, because your brother lives in Atlanta. That's the state I always think of when I think of kudzus. I think of Georgia because that's where I first saw it when I was a kid. I had family that lived down there, and we.
What is it?
It's that green vine that grows over everything.
Oh, yeah, it took over all of Tennessee.
It's like a carpet. Yeah.
It's crazy. I couldn't believe how big of a deal it is. I mean, it's terrible.
That has to be hard on the turkeys, isn't it?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, they definitely can't move through it. It's not really a source of food. You know, so it takes over an area and kind of, you know, blocks out everything else that the turkeys would potentially be eating because it has that carpeted effect where it just takes over trees and valleys and everything. So.
I don't understand, like, the stuff that comes here is just crazy invasive. How is it not invasive where it's from? Like, I understand the idea
ecology,
of checks.
Man.
I know the checks and balances, but what checks and balance is made for a vine that covers states, plural, at a time? You know what I mean?
Like, it would have to be some kind of herbivore that
like goats. He's got a bunch of goats out there
that spends time like eating not just at ground level but like up in trees and stuff like that, I would think, where it doesn't allow it to make that vertical climb. Maybe would be so maybe monkeys
I was thinking maybe monkeys. I don't know if they eat kudzu or not, but that's the first thing that came to mind.
It's like salad for monkeys. So it's all the mom monkeys making their kid monkeys eat salad, but the mom monkeys are eating like mangoes and Oreos.
Yeah. But no, this is what I like about doing the podcast is stuff like this pops into my head and then we got the right person to ask. So, but yeah, so I imagine that's, and we can get into maybe that's part of the equation too, with invasive species with why turkey populations are suffering a little bit, but, really described a good, you know, some good principles for a land manager to put into practice if they're wanting to manage for turkeys there. And honestly, I love hunting whitetail deer, and that's the main thing I care to manage for. And a lot of those practices that Casey mentioned are going to help for other species like whitetail deer or up here, pheasants. We already talked about the quail connection as well. And then most importantly, the whole ecosystem, right? So all the other non-game species that benefit from from a diverse landscape like that too. So all those insects that the turkeys are eating, a lot of them, you know, we need. They're pollinators, or they're they have some other important role within the ecosystem, and they benefit from all the that management as well. So yeah, great information there. Okay, my fun question. Craziest thing you found in a turkey crop, Casey?
Oh God. I'm not sure if I
it's not allowed to say it's like so disturbing.
Ever find like a frog or like a crawdad or something like that?
No, not I mean, I've heard of people finding, you know, crazy things, but I've never really found anything that made me step back and say,
Yeah.
I guess I'm not that lucky, but
yeah. Apparently wildlife's instincts are like very strong and they eat what they're supposed to. Unlike humans who eat plastic.
Yeah. If you cut open my crop, it'd be like Oreo fluff in there or something. Yeah. Probably, right?
Yeah. No, honestly, or, you know, like, what do we eat as a species? Tide pods, you know, turkeys don't have a problem with that.
Tide pods. Oh my God.
Yeah. I've never seen a Tide pod.
You've never seen one in a turkey. Casey, that's coming from someone who's like, yeah, I've certainly never eaten probably a Tide pod. I don't eat them. Yeah, just trying to play it off.
No, turkeys are interesting. And if anyone out there ever goes turkey hunting, make sure you examine the crop, because you might get lucky and be the person who finds they do have a bit of an odor to them. So just stand back when you cut it open, but. A lot of times if you shoot the bird first thing in the morning, it's not even broken down yet. You know, it's still whole and complete.
Yeah, as the grasshopper hops right on out.
Yeah, right. Good.
Still alive. But,
turkeys eat all sorts of things. They're omnivorous birds, but that's their unique role within their ecosystem.
Dude, what a terrible B-level horror movie. Turkeys like turning on humans, but they're like small, so they can't really do that much, and humans can just kind of kick them away, although they're big. They're like 50 pounds.
I would it wouldn't be just like a funny thing if you got attacked by a big tom. Like, you wouldn't be laughing by the end. You'd be like, no. you'd be thanking the Lord for saving you,
dude,
because they have those giant spurs on them, and they're fast. Mm-hmm. They're gonna way outrun you.
Really? I didn't know they were that fast.
Oh, man, yeah. Yeah.
Ken's been chased by a tom, but for sure.
I got chased by what was it? Is it sharp-tailed grouse that live in wooded areas? I feel like that's not the right grouse species. Anyways, I got chased by a grouse when I was a kid, and that was pretty terrifying. I couldn't believe how fast that thing was. And I was riding on the back of an ATV and facing the thing while it was chasing after me. And then it like hopped up and flew right at me. But, you know, that kind of thing. But,
my stepmom got chased by a barracuda for a while once.
Yeah. That's a barracuda. Yeah.
A barracuda. Yeah. She was snorkeling. Mm. Yeah. Isn't that horrifying?
Oh my God.
Yeah. I already like kind of hate being in the ocean, so I couldn't imagine.
Yeah, that'd be terrifying.
I'd lose my
razor teeth on those things. Okay, back to turkeys.
I always think about those YouTube videos that you see pop up of the mailman getting chased by a tom or something, you know.
Yeah, that's right. That is a problem sometimes, isn't it?
Yeah.
What toms are hanging out? Are there domesticated guard toms?
That's a real, like, that this comes up in the news like almost every year. Yeah. Like, there's some community that's being held hostage by like a couple turkeys that live in the woodlot behind. Yeah, like they get super territorial, mm-hmm. and people will just go to get out of their vehicle coming home from work, and they got to like sprint to the door because that thing will be on them, and they have to have like animal control and stuff coming. Yeah. There's almost every year, there's a story like that. It's usually some HOA somewhere. Right.
Yeah. And, where they've never seen a turkey before. So one human kicked it and now it's livid. Yeah.
Right.
I'm telling you, it's a movie. Yep, there's a movie in there.
A lot could be solved with a box call and some TSS. But anyways, but We'll talk about the history of turkeys a little bit briefly here, because then we're going to get to the main part of the conversation. But turkeys, historically, there was a major effort to bring turkeys, wild turkey populations back, because of they were extirpated throughout much of, especially the Midwest here. I'm not as familiar with down south. I know that Iowa eventually got their turkeys reestablished from turkeys in Missouri, actually. Wild turkeys that were trapped in Missouri and then released in Iowa. And that was only after trying from, like, I think they tried getting some from Wisconsin maybe and Minnesota, and they just weren't doing as well here. And so they thought that the climate that was in Missouri was more similar to what was going on in Iowa. And so they figured that the turkeys could do better here. And so they took those birds from Missouri and released them here, and they stuck. But a similar story is, you know, can be seen throughout much of the country, right? And NWTF has played a role in some of that, haven't they?
Yeah. Yes. So when you're talking about, you know, kind of transporting turkeys to one area from another area, you know, NWTF is always usually kind of involved in that process. Of course, you know, we want to make sure that we're not, you know, taking turkeys and transplanting them to another state or another area that doesn't have the right kind of habitat. We don't want to, you know, obviously throw them in a kudzu stand or something like that and expect them to survive. So we work a lot with the state agencies. Ultimately, you know, it's the state agency that decides, yes, we want to go ahead and kind of do a release of turkeys in this area that was
being, like, you know, the DNR or what state agencies?
So a lot of times, like down here in Mississippi, you know, the Mississippi Department of Wildlife, Fisheries and Parks, and you know, the state wildlife agency, basically. You know, we work a lot with them. If they decide, you know, hey, yes, we want to you know, possibly transplant some turkeys here in this area, we've been working on the habitat, we got the habitat back to where it needs to be, you know, that type of thing. And then they say, okay, yeah, let's go ahead and look into possibly transporting some turkeys and releasing turkeys in this area, the state that you know, once was, you know, very populated with turkeys, now necessarily doesn't have either any turkeys or very few turkeys on that area. So, you know, we work a lot with them in regards to getting that done. And of course, you know, we provide the transport boxes and stuff, you know, all the turkey boxes that you see with, you know, transported turkeys, that comes from us. The transport boxes were kind of our design, and we really perfected that over the years to be able to safely transport those turkeys, either, you know, within the state or to a different state.
How many, to get a population of turkeys, what is releasing that practically look like? Are you picking up 15, you're tagging them, and you're releasing them within a mile of each other? Or you know what I mean? How does that look? Because if you just were, like, released 8 in the state of Arkansas, and you were like, well, good luck finding each other, like, none of them are that loud, you know? You know, it's like dating in Southern California, you know what I mean? There's just, like, why everyone's single there? I don't know where that came from, but
Nick throwing shade on SoCal.
You've never been there, apparently.
I never have, no.
Never been there, yeah.
Goodness. No, you know, like I said, we work with the state agency, so, you know, they kind of make a guesstimate on, you know, the number of turkeys they want to go ahead and release on a tract of land and that type of thing. And then basically, you know, the truck shows up with the boxes and the turkeys inside, and they kind of line them all up, and then they open the boxes and out they fly. And, you know, a lot of times we do studies on them to make sure that they're doing okay, that they're being able to reproduce and kind of thrive within that environment as
well. Are they all, they all have trackers on them?
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes, you know, they will, you know, attach a tracker, so they can kind of monitor those efforts a little bit better.
Mm. So what's like a high number of turkey released in one area? Is it like 10 is a lot, or like 150, or?
Oh, good Lord. usually it's, within the teens,
okay.
I believe. I don't think we're catching 100 turkeys from, you know, Missouri and transporting them to Arkansas and doing this huge, you know, 250 turkey.
Yeah, just taking out the fence on a farm, basically, at that point.
Yeah, the idea is, you know, enough turkeys where they could potentially be able to reproduce and kind of start that population there.
And what's on the checklist of, like, this is a good track of land to let? Is it just everything we mentioned, having the cover, having the transitional cover, and having the open areas, or is there anything else?
Yeah. So when you're thinking about an ideal track land, you think about diversity, you know, not only diversity in the types of plants and stuff that you have, but also diversity in the environment. So do you have open areas? Do you have kind of bushier areas for them to nest in? Do you have roosting areas? Do you have areas, you know, streamside management areas in your you know, little tract of land that you're thinking about? So, you know, diversity is the key when it comes to turkeys, because, like I said earlier, with their lifespan, they kind of utilize different habitat types throughout their lifespan. So if you can have those habitat types relatively close to each other, you know, it almost guarantees their success to be able to not only make it to adulthood, but also, you know, get in on the breeding season and creating that population and growing and that type of thing.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. I just didn't know, cause I hear about that. Like we talked with Carter Niemeyer a little bit about the practicals, but that was with wolves and bears, which are much bigger, lower population, from my understanding, in terms of how many they can fit in an area.
Your understanding is correct.
Yeah.
Imagine releasing 15 grizzly bears. And that city picked up and moved.
Well, but think about it. It's crazy. You're like, oh, we're going to release 2 grizzly bears, 1 male, 1 female. Hopefully they find each other. They're 50 miles apart. You know what I mean? Like, that's nuts. And they find each other.
Yeah.
That's what's crazy. Because turkeys, you release 15. There's none for 50 miles. You know, they could never find, they could just not find a mate. I mean, practically, I guess they're, you know, they've got senses and some keen intuition that other people do not have. Other species. Intuition. Yeah, some mate finding.
Great at reading palms in the future and stuff like that.
they're like, they're just looking around. Oh, I got a sense. They got that sixth sense. So I'm obviously
call that
very
instinct.
I'm very
turkey instinct.
No, Ken, if you're finding a mate, it's definitely intuition. Imagine dating someone and be like, my instincts aren't good here. You know, it's mating, it's intuition.
Yeah, it probably wouldn't work out well. Yeah, you got
to. Yeah, I went to Bible college. We didn't learn these terms.
I like your terms, Nicholas.
Okay, all right.
Turkey intuition is a great concept. might lead to a PhD study someday.
Yeah, turkey intuition. Dude, what if it's like groundbreaking? What if it ends up like a rise of the planet of the turkey? And we are going
crazy right now. So
I haven't eaten anything all day. It's 2 p.m.
Yeah, Nicholas has been burning that midnight oil and then some to get ready for his coffee shop health inspection, which he had today.
I did. I've never been more stressed in my life. I should just tell you guys about it. I know it's not relevant, but listen, dishwashers are very difficult. And we got one, and it worked last night, and it failed today during the inspection.
That's how it goes, man.
That means you can't open. that means you're not allowed to open, which is not good. So we had, she was like, well, just change this sink to do this and this sink to do this, and then you should be able to open. I'm like, okay, cool. But I've the stress I felt was like sitting on my heart. It was like staring down a bear, except instead the bear was a very kind lady.
Yeah.
From the health department.
Yeah. I tell people, because they're like, wow, is starting a business hard? No, it's not that hard. Jumping through government hoops is very hard. Yep. It is so hard. I'm sure you understand, Casey. Anyway, let's talk about turkey.
Well, I'm glad things went well there. But speaking of going well, in some places of our country, that is not the case for wild turkeys. How'd you like that transition, Nicholas?
That was clever.
Some things are not going so well for wild turkeys in different parts of our country. And I think when this was first brought up, like brought to people's attention, I think I heard it on an episode of the Meat Eater podcast, like maybe 4 or 5 years ago, they mentioned it. And it was kind of like, really? I seem to see turkeys, you know, maybe even more than ever before. And then it started to come out, well, yeah, maybe in your neck of the woods, they're doing fine. But as a whole, no. And in some places, very much no. So when people talk about that, turkeys are hurting, what do they really mean?
So, you know, of course, with a lot of the research and stuff that they do on a state by state basis, when we, you know, think about turkeys and if they're thriving or if they're declining in numbers, a lot of times we think about, their poult to hen ratios. So when you're looking at two or less, you're kind of expecting that decline, right? You know, if there's only two hens or two poults per hen, that means, you know, what happened to the rest of them? You know, normally turkeys lay about 8 to 13 eggs and they can re-nest up to 3 times. But you know, when we're looking at poult to hen ratios of two or less, we're kind of thinking, okay, what's going on here? What is causing this? Why aren't we seeing more poult to hens, you know, in the 3s or 4s or 5s, you know, what's going on in this environment? And usually you're looking at a decline, and that decline can be habitat related. It could be, you know, development. It could be potentially hunting regulations need to be kind of scaled back in that area. There's a lot of factors that play into it. Even weather, a lot of times, you know, with the crazy weather patterns that we've been having across the United States, you know, the biggest one I can think of, as far as being in the Southeast here, you know, hurricanes, they can wipe out habitat for turkeys, you know, in a couple of days, sometimes in a couple of hours. So, you know, you start to see those, you know, poult to hen ratios declining once that they don't have the suitable habitat to be able to reproduce, to hide from predators, to get the right kind of food that they need to make it to adulthood. So, you know, there's a lot of things that can kind of play into that. But, you know, that's where we start seeing the declines is, you know, when we're doing those studies, when we're doing the research and that type of thing, and we get this data back that says, okay, hey, your poult to hen ratio is a little bit on the low side. What's happening? What's causing that?
Mm-hmm. And what do you, obviously, depending on if it's different things, you do different things, but let's start with habitat. What do you, so habitat across Mississippi, just as an example, let's say, there's a lot less habitat and your turkeys are in decline because you got like a 2.5 to 1 ratio. What are you doing about that? You know, how do you even start to address that?
Yeah, so, you know, we like to go into an area and kind of look at, you know, what's going on with the habitat there. Is it being overtaken by invasive species? Can we utilize more prescribed burn on the ground to kind of generate that early successional habitat that we want to bring up? You know, the turkeys that thrive in, I was talking about those bunch grasses and forbs and legumes and that type of thing. You know, habitat is usually the key to bringing back turkey numbers, right? Mm. Because habitat plays such an important role in their lifespan and that diversity of habitat. So, you know, a lot of people think, okay, well, maybe it's because there's just crazy invasive species growth. You have kudzu, you have kogan grass, you have privet, you have yaupon, all these things kind of shading out what you would want to grow or what you would want having grown in that area, you know, as far as the food that would be beneficial to turkeys. So, you know, going in, kind of evaluating what needs to be done to the habitat, what kind of disturbance can we do to the habitat to be able to get the things that we want there that the turkeys will benefit from. You know, like I said, prescribed burning is a big one here in the Southeast. Hmm. You know, that can control invasive species. It can also generate the types of growth that you want, that early successional habitat. Is it because there's been developments popping up and now you have, you know, just these little patches here and there where turkeys, you know, are only able to survive because the rest is a subdivision? You know, a lot of times you hear about potential, okay, we have, you know, hundreds of raccoons on this 100-acre track. What's going on here? That type of thing. Or, you know, it's always important to note, if you have the right habitat types and diversity, you can have a very healthy turkey population and you can have a very healthy predator population as well. It all depends on habitat. So we always go back to habitat as being the number one factor to determine whether turkeys are going to be able to thrive in that area or, you know, are we going to see those numbers decline?
That's interesting that you bring that point up, and important that you bring that point up, because I know, as someone who's in the hunting community, predators are probably the first thing that hunters will blame for the decline of turkeys. And there's a real effort by a lot of folks put into trapping raccoons and coyotes and, of course, hunting them as well. Bobcats, same deal. Foxes, on and across the board. And I would say probably if anything gets blamed more, it's going to be the raccoons, and then it's going to be the coyotes, I would say. And, you know, I think there could, like, that's probably part of it, right? Like, we have more raccoons now than probably ever before. They're just one of those, you know, examples of a species that throughout human altering of the land, raccoons have thrived. There's no doubt about it. We all put, you know, a giant two-wheeled buffet at the end of our driveways once a week for that raccoons love to go and get free food from. And, you know, the same thing can be said to some extent with coyotes. They've done really well. Despite humans changing much of the landscape, they've expanded their range across the United States from where we believe they were, was more their native range at one time. And so I'm sure that's part of it, but habitat is the bigger thing. Like, if somebody wanted to spend their time really helping the problem, they would spend the bulk of their time just improving the habitat. And then the predator management side of it would be a secondary approach, right?
Yeah. You know, it always goes back to habitat. You know, what is off with the habitat that it's, you know, the turkeys aren't able to survive in and make it to adulthood? Is it something in the habitat that makes it, you know, hard for turkeys to conceal their nests, to have that adequate cover from potential, you know, predators that might be lurking and that type of thing? And also, you know, is your habitat actually more beneficial to predators versus turkeys, and you know, kind of figuring out what you need to do to manipulate that, so you know, that's you can have that response in turkeys to be able to adequately conceal their young, and then be able to make it to adulthood.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point. Yeah, I like how you said that. Is the habitat more conducive to the predator than it is to the turkey? And that is a great point. And honestly, here in Iowa, Nicholas, I think I've mentioned this before, but we can be guilty of that, because when you think of a lot of our habitat, it's going to be CRP acres, and a lot of CRP acres are very rectangular, long strips that border a, you know, stream bank or something like that. And that would be a classic example of habitat that favors a predator more than the prey, because it's like just this long straight pipeline that they can just work, you know, a coyote can work right down that pipeline and cover it like a bird dog. You know what I mean? Whereas if you had like a big odd shaped, you know, more natural looking, you know, arrangement of habitat, it's just way harder for the predator to cover that and find the poults or
that goes against human psychology. Yes, we like our we like our categories and our squares and
our symmetry. Yes. Yep.
And we talk about habitat like it's this idealized perfect thing, like we talk about doing a math equation well, and it's just not that. It's so, which I can't imagine, Casey, your job, because habitat is so nuanced, it's so different. It's so something could have none of the same flora and still be great habitat for turkey in two different locations. And so you're like so nuanced on it, and like what side of the hill is it on, where's the sun shining, you know, there's like all sorts of things that it's like you can't just go in, ask a few questions, be like, oh yeah, that's probably good habitat, you know. It's just I couldn't imagine doing your job, because like you're covering states, but then you get down to like an acre of land, and each state that you cover has tens of millions of acres in it, right? So I think it also goes to show how when we're looking at several different spots that have a few hundred acres for turkeys, how diminished we have caused the habitat to get, or reduced, you know, their habitat, where it's like, oh yeah, we can name all the good spots that are like 500 acres. We can name all of them in a few states, but it's like, well, there used to be million acre patches of good habitat for turkey, you know, or, you know, where tons and tons of it is good habitat, because it's so nuanced, and it across that million acres would range so much that a bunch of it's going to end up being great. And I think, you know, again, it doesn't fit with our square model of this is good habitat, this is bad habitat, this is where the predators can live, this is where turkey are going to live, I'm going to put up an electric fence, I'm going to control this habitat exactly how I want to control it. How do you talk to landowners about that? Because when you're a landowner, and I fully understand this, we really want to control our space. So it's not that often you meet a landowner that's like, no, I really want the natural order of things to occur on this land. So how do those conversations go?
So when I would meet with a landowner, one of the biggest things I would always preach is diversity. What diversity do you have on your property? What diversity can we create on your property? And again, it's going back to, do you have openings, on your property, or is it all just timber stands? You know, kind of just trying to create that different diversity that the turkeys need to utilize throughout their lifespan, you know, and going in and manipulating the environment to be able to achieve those results. Whether, you know, again, prescribed burning, one of the biggest things that we preach here in the Southeast, you can do a lot of different you know, techniques with prescribed burning, depending upon the time of year or how you actually light the fire, and it rolls through the actual stand to achieve different effects, to be able to create that diversity that the turkeys depend on throughout their lifespan. So that's the number one thing that I always preach is upping the diversity on your property. The more diverse the habitat that you have on your property, the more it's going to be utilized by turkeys.
Interesting. So this is a very selfish question that I'm just curious about. We have something called a perennial food plot, which Kent had alluded to, and it's become fairly popular, but I don't hear too, like, people aren't asking about it for turkeys too often, but what do you think of that? So in the perennial food plot, it's all Midwest shortgrass. Obviously, it wouldn't work in Mississippi, but you've got Midwest shortgrass, clump grass, and then you've got like 38 forbs or something like that. And they range from blooming in May till the last ones would wither away in mid-October probably. And then we have a bunch of legumes. Some will hold their seed for weeks. Some drop them on the ground right away. Would you kind of consider that a good quote unquote open area, or does it need to be more open than that? Because there is some like kind of overage where like young quail and I don't know if that can kind of hang out and be covered. I didn't know if that would also be relevant for turkeys. I don't know. What are your thoughts on what I was saying?
You're talking about, you know, a bunch of different seed mixes kind of mixed together, blooming at different times of the year. That creates that different food source that they can utilize, right? So instead of going out there and just planting one species of plant across the entire food plot, a lot of times what I recommend is either planting, you know, if you're going to kind of segregate your different species of plant, right? Instead of getting a mix of it all together, you know, you can plant different strips of it. So you can plant, like, you know, you're going to plant clover here, you're going to plant, you know, wheat here, all within the same food plot. So the diversity of your, you know, your food plots kind of help create that food source throughout the year, because they have the different blooms coming in spring, summer,
and
fall.
Do you that type think of it's thing. Better to have them in rows separate from each other, or to mix all of that together? Because I'm talking about natives, and I know clover, it does a lot for the environment. So I have used clover before when people were like really want it specifically for deer, but I don't normally put it in or red clover. Right. I normally do like a purple prairie clover and white prairie clover or some pretty good legumes. But yeah, what do you think? What do you think of those being mixed together?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can definitely mix them. You can definitely not mix them. It's kind of more, I guess, what the landowner feels comfortable with doing, okay. Right? It's their property. If they only want to plant two different kinds of things within their field, then, you know, by all means, you're more than welcome to do that, you know.
Yeah.
But just kind of creating that diversity. So, you know, if you go out and get a mix of stuff that you want to plant in that field and, you know, mix it all up, that's fine too, you know. It's just creating that diversity within the area that you're either going to be utilizing as a wildlife opening versus a food plot.
So yeah. if the land, let's say the landowner says, hey, you're the expert, you decide, and I have unlimited resources to make it happen, what would you put in an open area?
Well, normally I would probably, you know, I keep saying, you know, wildlife opening versus food plot, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, a wildlife opening is something that you kind of just let it naturally evolve. So like down here in the South, you know, wildlife openings are usually kind of within a timbered stand. And when we go in and burn that stand, we burn the wildlife opening as well. It creates that seed bank response that we want to see, you know, in those areas versus a food plot where you go in and you specifically plant a certain thing that you want to get planted there. So, you know, you go in and you plant clover in the food plot, or you plant winter wheat, or you know, anything that you want to basically plant in there. So you're going in and purposely putting something in there, whereas a wildlife opening is kind of just maintained, you know, kind of naturally. You're not necessarily going in there and planting anything. You're letting that seedling response come through to create that successional habitat that you want. You know, so I always recommend, you know, wildlife openings versus food plots. You know, of course we sell a lot of seed. We have seed programs. The NWTF has seed programs and stuff for their members. So we do promote seed, but out on, you know, a habitat standpoint, can we utilize wildlife openings over actual food plots? I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with going in and doing a food plot, you know, especially, you know, one that's going to produce something throughout the year, as opposed to just one time a year. But, you know, we really want to try to tap into the native, you know, species of plant, because those are the most nutritious, right? Those are what turkeys have been relying on for, you know, generations and generations. And now we have all the seed that we can throw out there and, you know, basically plant whatever we want. But if we can get that response naturally, that is what we're going for.
Mm. Cool.
Yeah. Great questions, Nicholas, and great answers there, Casey. I think there's a lot there for our listeners who have some influence over some ground that they want to manage for turkeys.
Yo,
a little more effectively.
Like,
they can take that away
it's been like an hour and 20 minutes. I cannot believe that. Oh my goodness.
This is a great conversation.
That's shocking. I did not think I'd have fun with turkeys.
I have one burning question that I want to ask, and then we won't take any more of your time here, Casey. But when we're talking about the fact that turkey populations as a whole are struggling, is that just Eastern wild turkeys, or is a similar trend seen, you know, even with all the other subspecies we mentioned at the beginning of this episode, like are Merriam's herding out west and Rios and Goulds and Osceola? I mean, are they all seeing a similar, you know, depression in their population?
Yeah. So, of course, you know, Easterns take up the majority of the United States. So, you know, when we think about turkeys in general, a lot of people think, okay, you know, Eastern turkeys are severely declined, you know, versus, you know, another species of turkeys, you know, like, what are the numbers look like across the board? And, you know, it depends on where you're at. You know, again, you have those little pockets that are just thriving, and then you have a bunch of areas that are seeing, you know, those declining rates and that type of thing. You know, so NWTF is really investing in research to kind of figure out what's going on in different parts of the country. So we want to know, you know, why turkeys are declining, you know, in this state, but they're thriving in this other state. You know, is this species doing better, or, you know, in one area versus this species, when you have those two different species within a state? So, you know, we're investing highly in a lot of research to kind of answer those gaps of information that we're wanting to know, right? We want to know, you know, first of all, we want to know, you know, regional and national populations, population abundant estimates, right? We want to know exactly how many turkeys are out there and what is, you know, making them thrive in one area versus another area. We also, you know, are trying to figure out the best harvest management strategies too. You know, when you think about Easterns and in the various different states, you know, you have a bunch of different regulations going on. You have one state with one regulation and they can harvest, you know, this many gobblers versus another state that has very restrictive, you know, hunting regulations in their part of the areas, you know. So what's going on with the correlation between those. Why is one doing better and these guys aren't, you know? So we're really trying to answer those gaps that we have in the data. And that's why NWTF is investing so much in the research, because, you know, turkeys back in the early 1900s, you know, had a very different environment than what we're living in today.
That's for sure.
Not only, you know, with development and that type of thing, but also weather patterns and that type of thing, you know, it's very different than what it used to be back then. So, you know, there's declines across the United States. But again, you have those pockets that are, you know, for some reason thriving. And what is that reason? What can we do to kind of mimic that reason in areas that are potentially on the decline? What can we do to help those areas, you know, with their turkey population and that type of thing? Yeah. So just investing in the research where we're finding gaps in the data. You know, we have a lot of great research that, you know, happened and has gone on, but some of that is 10, 15 years old, you know.
Yeah.
We need current data that is applicable to, you know, this day and age. So that's one of the biggest things is we're trying to, you know, fill in those gaps in data. And one of the things that we always think about, you know, with declining populations, you know, you can have an area in a couple miles of each other that one area is doing fantastic and the other one's not, right? So kind of trying to figure out that relationship as well. And when you think about increasing turkeys, we're thinking about nesting and brood rearing habitat, right? That early successional habitat, the areas that have a lot of protein and bugs and that type of thing. So you know, how can we increase that across the landscape, and will that increase in the habitat types help overall with the turkeys being able to thrive within those areas? So, you know, we're trying to fill in those gaps of the data that we can get a better and better understanding of what is actually happening with the declines in turkey numbers that we're seeing across the United States.
Yeah, it all makes sense, and it's good to hear that large scale view, but also, you know, focusing in on each individual region of our country too, and seeing what's going on there. And I feel like we got a great education today, Nicholas, on a topic that's kind of been a blind spot for us, you know, on this podcast. And something, you know, it's fun to talk about the things that used to be here, bison and elk and stuff like that. But it's important to be focused on the things that are here and keep an eye on how they're doing, because they aren't invincible. Thankfully, a lot of them do well and stick around pretty well, but they are not invincible. That's for sure. So, well, man, I guess if we had a question to finish up on, it would be, if you could change one thing for wild turkeys, what would it be? Yeah, just like in across North America, if there was one thing that you could change, what would it be?
So I was kind of confused by that question a little bit okay. when I saw that. like
maybe one improvement, like one improvement that you could do or something like that.
One improvement that you could do for turkeys, not necessarily changing the turkey itself.
Right. Yeah. I'd give them, I'd make every hen a bearded hen. Right. Or no, biologists would probably take away the beards on the hens, because sometimes they're allowed to be harvested in some states.
Yeah. So one thing that I guess I would want to change for turkeys is, I guess just a better understanding, you know, what are the specific practices for each region that we can implement that will show a positive increase in the population? You know, when we think about conservation efforts, you know, I mean, the story of the turkey is highly successful. It's one of the best stories in conservation that can be told, right? We were down to just a little over, I think, a million birds in the early 1900s, and now we're sitting in between 6 and 7 million birds. Of course, you know, we're starting to see a decline in those numbers, but we also have to remember that we can't take that conservation success for granted, right? And that's indicated of the declines that we're starting to see. Were we taking it for granted? Were we not keeping up with the research? Were we not, you know, filling in those data gaps, that type of thing? So, you know, just trying to, I guess, get a better understanding of, you know, the factors that face turkeys today in regards to the decline that we're seeing, and how we can better, I guess, manage the species for future generations.
Yeah, excellent answer. Very good. Well, thank you so much, Casey, for joining us on this episode. And I'm so glad I went down south to find somebody. I just feel like I'm sure we got great turkey biologists up here. But like I said, I think you guys have a little bit, it's closer to home for you guys, what's going on with turkeys. And of course, just the fun things we learned about turkeys in the South, especially the quail part. I think that was my favorite fact, how they kind of like look out for each other a little bit. That's pretty cool. So, thanks so much though, for jumping on with us. The listeners, please, make sure if you haven't yet, leave a rating for this podcast. Nicholas did a recent plea for ratings.
I did.
Nicholas, do your little spiel for how you want people to rate again.
Well, look, it's 5-star. No, I don't know about manipulative. If you give us a 5-star rating, you know what we're going to do for you? We're going to keep making the podcast. But if you're like, well, I'm going to rate it, but I don't have a 5-star, that won't change nothing. You know what? Change something. Email us before you give the lower than 5-star review. So if you love it, give us a 5-star review. If you're not feeling it, shoot us an email. We might be able to get a guest or something on that could change your mind about it, because that's what we're about. But before we get into that, you got to look into some native perennial food plots, because apparently they're also open wildlife areas for turkey, but they're great food plots for quail, for pheasants, for white-tailed deer. They're specifically for the Midwest, although recently I had several people from the West Coast ask for some stuff, and I made a mix and I got it from closer to the West Coast because we really believe in regional conservation. But Ken, you want me to take it away? Are you taking it away?
Just as Nicholas said, reach out if you have any kind of seeding needs or maybe even just need advice on a habitat plan or something like that. We have quite a bit of experience between all of us here at Hoxie, but if we don't, we know cool people like Casey that we can reach out to and get some advice on what exactly works best for your property. And that, like Nicholas said, you know, that's our ultimate goal when we're selling seed. It's not just, oh, great, we're making money, we can keep the lights on. No, we
trust us. If we were trying to make a bunch of money, we'd go do something else.
Yeah, there's not a lot. The conservation is not a lucrative space, right, Casey? But it provides a lot of that altruistic value, and it's important that we see that. And so, you come to us, we're going to try and help you make it work for your specific project that you have going on. And we're just so thankful to all the customers that also listen, who've been buying seed for their backyard pollinator patches or their big CRP plantings or their food plots like we talked about, or even some people have seeded into native lawns. And so all sorts of great stuff, though, that we've been, you know, that's a kind of feedback that we love getting from our listeners. So do remember, this podcast is presented by Hoxie Native Seeds. You can go to hoxienativeseeds.com to see all that we have to offer, things that we just talked about, and then also theprairiefarm.com. And be paying attention to Hoxie's social media. Joy is helping us out there, and we need it. We need it.
We do. She is. I feel like the fact that we've gone as far as we have is like miraculous. But the girl's got a big brain on her. She's got a big old brain. So. Yeah.
So if you're not following along, make sure you follow along with Hoxie Native Seeds and The Prairie Farm on Instagram and Facebook, and you'll get to see more of what we're up to here on the farm at Hoxie. But yeah, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks, Casey.
Thank you to our listeners. Remember, conservation happens one mind at a time.